Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the sound, it's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're going to open up talking about voting in the upcoming presidential primary this Tuesday with Connecticut Secretary of the State Denise Merrill. We'll hear about the explosion of new voters who are energized by today's political campaigns and how Connecticut is making it easier than ever to get involved by registering to vote. Then we'll turn our attention back to the opiate epidemic gripping the state and check in with the Governor's Prevention Partnership to find out about two new and important campaigns to educate residents, especially our youth, about the deadly risks associated with opiates, as well as a program to oppose legalizing marijuana for recreational use. Then we'll wrap up learning about Connecticut's exchange clubs and how exchange club members and leadership are pitching in to support local and global organizations to help make everyone's world a little better place. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. Have you heard about Without Myeloma? Well, it is a 5-on-5 wiffle ball tournament. Teams are forming now and are limited to a total of 10 teams of 5 players each. The event is coming up Saturday, May 14th at 10 a.m. at Hotchkiss Field, Route 69 Prospect. You can help cure multiple myeloma by making a donation, creating a team, registering to play. You can even sponsor a team. We ask that you share this information with family and friends and ask for their support, or come out to the field on game day to help or support the effort. Help get the word out, and together we can help cure multiple myeloma in our lifetime. If you'd like more details or find out how to donate, go to wiffleball.myeloma.org. Well, it's just a couple of days before the presidential primaries in Connecticut, and we are so pleased to welcome back to the program Connecticut Secretary of the State Denise Merrill, who is on the line with us from Hartford on this busy, busy week before the primaries. Secretary Merrill, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So let's get down to it. Let's talk primary, namely where to find a person's polling place, or I guess that would even be putting the cart before the horse. Let's talk about registration. There's some exciting stuff going on right now in Connecticut.
Yes, we have in the last few years made it easier than ever to register to vote, and I think it's working. And that's plus the inordinate interest in this primary. So we have, something like 88,000 new voters in Connecticut since January, and that's a huge increase from previously. So It's very exciting. We're relevant here in Connecticut because nothing is settled. And so right now we're seeing a big surge on our online voter registration, but by now that time will be passed, so you can't use that anymore for the primary. So if you are an unaffiliated voter and you still wish to affiliate with a party, it's not too late. You can go in person to a registrar's office in your town hall and register to vote. So you can just change your affiliation, or you can register for the first time, actually right up through Monday at noon.
Okay, great. So as people are hearing this on Sunday, if they're unaffiliated and they want to get registered, they need to make plans to appear in person at their own residence, the town hall of the town of their residence in Connecticut, and make contact with the registrars of voters.
Correct. And you can change your registration. Let's say you were registered at a different town. You can change it to the new town. You can affiliate with a party if you weren't affiliated with the opposite party, because that deadline has passed. But if you're just unaffiliated or you've never been registered, you can register to vote. You have to have some ID with you, and it's pretty simple, really. So we're seeing lots and lots of people registering, some for the first time.
Excellent. So we chatted for a couple moments before we turned on the microphone, and it's exciting not only because it's ahead of a very important presidential primary, but it's exciting because there's a lot of opportunities available to get people to register, and obviously people are taking great advantage of that. To what do you attribute this explosion in voting besides the excitement over the primaries?
Well, I do think we have made it very available. I think, you know, in the way we were doing things before, everything was all on paper, and now we have offered more than ever many more ways to get registered and places to get registered. The big change was the online voter registration system, which would allow people to register within, you know, it takes about a minute. And if you have a Connecticut driver's license or a permit or a Connecticut ID, that is the easiest thing to do. And we're seeing over 50% of our registrations are already coming in online.
And
you know, it's just, I think there's a new understanding of it. I think for better or worse, the excitement of this primary and the kinds of debates that have been going on have really reinvigorated the public's interest in all this.
Well, that must do your heart good as a as both an official or I should say having official capacity over business related to Connecticut voters, but also having a personal passion that we share for the right and the privilege to vote.
Absolutely. And, you know, people used to, in my generation, I guess, think it was your duty to vote. I don't think people feel so much like that anymore. But I think it's very healthy. The more people are talking about elections, are thinking about these issues, I think it's better. Even if it's sometimes something you don't want to hear, it does make everyone think. And get involved, and that is a good thing.
I also have to say, to the credit of many of my media colleagues, that it really seems like media sources are digging in a lot deeper to try to really thoroughly, clearly, and simply as possible, you know, explain the nuances of how a vote is registered and why and the difference that it could make.
Yes, and I think it has also shown people that there's a lot of different laws in different states. I think the different caucuses and primaries in all these states, I've had multiple emails from people all over the country saying, why is it this way? Why in Connecticut can you not vote in a primary, for example, if you're not a member of a party? What's the basis of all that? So I think it's also making everyone think about the entire primary system and the way we select a president.
As you're seeing all of this kind of playing out and the interest in the way different states are doing things, are you formulating any ideas or proposals about any other substantive changes in the way Connecticut residents and citizens either come to or go through the process of becoming a voter, or the way that the state of Connecticut handles its elections and vetting and proposing candidates?
Well, I think Connecticut is, as it turns out, fairly liberal in its interpretation of a party. Most of these rules are formed by the parties themselves. And there have been cases that have gone all the way to the Supreme Court about the right of other people who are not members of parties to participate in a party primary. And it basically comes down to the fact that a party can decide under the constitutional right of free association who can be a member of their party and what their rights are. And so a lot of it is not controlled by state or federal law. It's controlled by party rule. In Connecticut, we do have a closed primary. I can see the argument both sides of it as to whether everyone, even if they're unaffiliated, should be able to participate, as they do, for example, in New Hampshire, where I suppose, you know, pretty much anybody can come and just be a Republican or a Democrat or whatever they want. But in Connecticut, I think, you know, when we tried to change that, we were kind of forestalled by the courts. But I can also see a party not wanting to have people completely unattached to that party try to throw an election by, you know, having a whole group of people come in and, you know, let's say vote for a candidate who might be easier to defeat. I mean, so there's all kinds of, you know, competitive, nefarious things that go on during elections. But there's probably reasons over time that all these things have evolved. I think we have a pretty good system here. What I would change is I would make our electronic ways of being able to register to vote even more available. I'd make it So you could register online right up to the day of election. For no reason we couldn't do that. And we have, during a general election now in Connecticut, we have something called Election Day Registration, where you can literally just go in on Election Day, register, and vote. Mm-hmm. And again, with modern technology, with databases that can be checked instantly, there's really no reason we couldn't do that on a primary day as well.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the things I'll probably propose in the next few years.
Oh, great. Well, a few weeks ago when we were visiting with Governor Malloy, we were talking a little bit about ways that the DMV was diversifying. And I see that the DMV is also a subject on your radar in terms of automatic voter registration.
Yes, that's right. As a matter of fact, you know, under the 1993 Motor Voter Act, the DMV was required to do voter registration every time they did a driver's license application. You know, they should offer you an opportunity to vote, to register to vote, and have cards there to register. And under my proposal, again, it would all be done electronically with the new system. So when you come to get your driver's license, it would get, you know, you give the name and address and so forth, and they would say, are you eligible or would you like to register to vote? And you see, it would automatically go into our automatic process, and it would be so simple that way.
Mm-hmm. And is where are we in the process of getting that accomplished?
Well, that's the problem. As everyone knows by now, DMV has other problems. And, you know,
well, as of yesterday, the press release I got yesterday said everything was all set.
Well, that's good news. they've been a good partner with us on the online voter registration piece because it's really our system. And what it does is it goes in and checks the signature that the DMV got when the person came in to get a driver's license. And that way we can cross-check the signature without the person being present.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole way this our system works. But, you know, I think it could be a lot better. It will really streamline that whole voter registration process at DMV. You know, other states, something like 80% of all their voter registrations come from DMV, which is, you know, nowhere near where we are. So I think that system could be much more useful. And, you know, I'm even to the point where I say if someone turns 18 and they're a citizen, why shouldn't they just be registered to vote? I mean... You know, they have a right to vote. They have a right to be registered.
Yeah, so. make them opt out instead of opting in.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you're a citizen and you're 18, you should be voting. You should be a registered voter. That's my attitude. We know from statistics and data that the first act of citizenship is really that registering to vote. That once people register, they're much more likely to go ahead and vote after that, especially when they're young. So those people who actually make the act of registering to vote when they're 18 really do follow through much more likely than someone who waits until they're, let's say, 30. And there's a lot of those people now. So I think it's really almost an act of civic education to get young people registered to vote at an early age.
In line with that, are you still seeing and supporting maybe not a robust, but at least an effective level of civic education within the school system? I know you go to schools all the time to talk to people. Do you find as you're going through local school systems that there is still at least a superficial commitment to try to bring children up through the years until they turn 18, educating them about their rights, responsibilities, and privileges to vote?
Oh, I think this is an enormous issue right now. Actually, it's a national issue. For many, many years, I actually taught civic education. And when I was in the legislature, I had Connecticut passed a bill that was my bill to require a course in civic education for every high school graduate to graduate from Connecticut. That was in 2003. And I still remember at the time, people in the legislature were like, well, of course we would do that. I mean, isn't it required now? Because everyone is thinking it's just like it was when they went to school, but it's not. Because civics is not on the test. So all the testing has driven education very far from this basic notion that schools are a place where you are educated for citizenship. You're educated now to read and write and do math and, you know, the STEM education and so forth. So it is an enormous national issue. It's beginning to be addressed, and there are many groups working on trying to get civics back in the curriculum, particularly for young children. That's where you really first get your ideas of what it means to be a citizen of the world.
Well, in the last few minutes that we have with you, let's look to the future. We talked a little bit about possibly how Connecticut's voting landscape and elections landscape may change. But technology is constantly changing. We buy it today and it's obsolete tomorrow. What are some other things? We've got about a minute and a half, that are on your radar screen in terms of other ways to modernize and make the process of either getting registered or following through to be able to register your votes more effective?
Well, nationally, we are going to start seeing a much more national list. I think we're already doing some cooperation with other states to get our records clear. You know, like I always say, your credit card company can find you no matter what state you live in, mm-hmm. and they, pretty quickly at that. Whereas we are still working with state-by-state lists, there's a lot of mobility now. We think there's about 12 million people who are registered in at least two states because they moved and they just figured it followed them. So, and we're not allowed to take names off a list without a great deal of background checking. So I think that's one thing you're going to see is more sharing of lists, more, you know, better lists so that things will be more efficient in many, many ways. And that, you know, the voters will just not see it as a process that might be, you know, convoluted. No one wants to stand in line for 2 hours for anything anymore. So I think you're going to see things like checking people in at table. You know, when you come to vote, you'll be checked in by laptop, and it'll all be computerized, which will be a huge change from where we are now. It's still really a paper-based system, which is quite antique at this point. So I like to say sometimes we're going to try to drag it into the 20th century, if not the 21st. I think those are the kinds of changes you're going to see that will be helpful. And maybe at some point in this state, hopefully we'll get some version of early voting, which definitely means you won't be standing in line on election day because it will. Many states have this already. We don't in Connecticut, but which means you'd be able to vote on, let's say, you know, up to a month. In advance and come in and vote or mail in your vote. Oregon, all the votes are mailed in. Everything is mailed. They mail you a ballot. If you voted in the last election, you mail it back and you're done.
Do you ever envision or do you hear from your technological prognosticators that Connecticut may ever see the day, at least as we speak now, when we'll be voting online in our pajamas from our mobile devices or our laptops or desktop computers?
Well, I don't know. You know, the people in my world throw up their hands in horror at the idea because these systems are still not that secure. And every time people start talking about, let's do online voting, then Target or someone will be hacked. And everyone's like, well, maybe not such a great idea.
Oh, great. Good to know what we're ruling in.
Never in this world, you know.
Still good to know what we're ruling in and ruling out. But what we got to make sure you're not ruling out is skipping the primary. And as we've heard from Secretary of the State, Denise Merrill, still plenty of opportunities for you to be involved in Tuesday's primary. Polls are open in Connecticut from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, the 26th of April. And I know on behalf of Secretary of the State, Merrill, we hope that you will get registered if you're not already. If you qualify, then please get out and vote take advantage of that privilege as an American citizen. Secretary of the State, Merrill, we thank you so much for joining us again on the program. Well, we've been talking about this with more frequency and intensity in recent months. I'm talking about Connecticut's growing heroin crisis and the Governor's Prevention Partnership, which has been such a great resource to our listeners and a great asset and friend to our program here at the award-winning For the People. They're continuing to work to get to the root of the problem. The Governor's Prevention Partnership has launched a couple of initiatives. The first is called Mind Your Meds, and a social network initiative called hashtag StopPotCT to reduce opioid and marijuana use. We've heard so often that marijuana is a gateway drug and does lead to the use of other drugs, including opioids. Joining us today is Jill Spinetti, a long and dear friend of ours, president and CEO of the Governor's Prevention Partnership. So, Jill, real quick, if you would just review for our listeners who may not be familiar with it, the Governor's Prevention Partnership. This organization has been around for quite a long time. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yes, we've been working on issues affecting youth for the last 26 years. And our main goal as a nonprofit organization is to work to keep them positive in school, safe, successful, and drug-free. So the one thing that we do the most is really look at all those trends and harms that are facing the young people in the state of Connecticut. And over the years, they do keep changing. And you hit the nail on the head that right now it is opioids and marijuana. So we want to stay front and center on that issue and both advocate for resources and then bring direct programs into the community to help them.
It does seem like you've been with the effort for much of the GPP's history. Certainly they've been a fixture on our program since 1989. There has always been a concern and a concentration on heroin, but as pharmaceuticals began to enter into the picture and have now grown into a massive proportional element of this opioid epidemic that we're talking about, it almost seems like we're talking about heroin and prescription or pharmaceutical opioids now as one big entity.
Yes, and you're right. I have been doing this work for 18 years, and we are in the middle of a crisis. It's been called that by the governor, and I believe even the president of the United States. And you're exactly right, John, that there is no difference between synthetic drugs such as oxycodone, methadone, hydrocodone. There's a whole class of drugs there, and heroin. It's the same exact drug. One is synthetic and one is natural. The heroin is grown from a plant source, mm-hmm. but they act the same exact way.
So as I said, this is something that you've got a lot of experience in dealing with, although this latest incredible upward spike must be extremely disturbing to all involved.
Well, yes. The worst problem of all is we're losing people. Last year alone, we had 723 people overdose, and not all of those were young people, which is our main concern, but still people are dying. And the other big issue, John, I think you probably already know, is this cuts across every community. So communities that are more affluent, rural areas, suburban areas, and the urban areas are all being hit. Problem, and people that you never would have thought in a million years, you know, the boy or girl next door, a working mother, these are the people that are getting hooked on heroin. So that's why we have such cause for concern.
Well, we are being told on the program that actually the preponderance of addicts and overdose deaths has kind of shifted even from what our parents and grandparents' idea of the destitute street corner overdose victim to a proportionately larger group of middle class to affluent young Caucasian males between the ages of 17 and 25 or so.
Yes, and that's the heartbreak to me when I pick the paper up and read about another obituary of a young person, a young life snuffed out, and you're exactly right. And I'm here today to say I think that's directly related to an increase in opioid use by young people, painkillers. Mm.
And this brings us to Mind Your Meds.
It brings us to Mind Your Meds, and the good news in Connecticut is from the governor all the way down, there is a lot going into the heroin epidemic itself to get people treatment, to make sure we can keep them alive through use of Narcan. And then our group is looking at the other end, the prevention end of how people in the first place. And Peter Helms, who's a really good friend of the organization, has been doing a lot of interviews with me. You know, he had his appendix out when he was 17 years old. And they gave him, I don't know, a 30-day, I think, back then doctors were more generous in their prescribing of oxycodone. And at the end of the 30 days, he was actually starting to have physical withdrawals from the drug, called the doctor, and they wouldn't refill the prescription. And so he started looking around to see where else he could get the pills.
And that that led him to years of abuse.
Well, it did because, first of all, he couldn't afford the pills to get them. You know, there's $50 a pill or sometimes more if you try to get them illegally on the street. And so somebody who we knew came to him and said, you know, Peter, for $10, you can be doing it this way. And that the other way was heroin. Now, I don't want to tell all of his story because that is definitely his story to tell about, you know, the depths that he had to get to turn to recovery, which is what he's doing right now. But his he's not alone in that story. This is happening to many, many people in Connecticut.
Yeah, and the bottom line is that so many of these drugs that, that may start off as an occasional recreational trip develops into addiction, and a lot of the drugs that are pouring into that kind of recreational experimental supply chain are coming in through the unknown or inadvertent taking of those pills from the medicine cabinets of folks who have them legitimately prescribed.
Well, you're exactly right. That's exactly how it's happening. And young people or anybody is saying, well, it's, you know, they're medically prescribed. There's it's a safe. It's not a street drug. I'm getting it out of a medicine cabinet. So there's this false sense of security that they can go ahead and take the drug and not have the consequences. And so I'm glad you're getting the message out about the addictive quality of these drugs. And if someone's prone to addiction, they have alcoholism in their family, there's a wide variety of things that come together for someone to be addicted. But for those people that are prone, they can go into full-blown addiction by just experimenting with these drugs.
So I guess at this point, we can't say it enough. We can't warn people enough and try to remind people enough that if they have any type of opioid painkillers, whether they've just come into the house from a dental procedure or a broken bone from spring sports practice or what have you, all the way to something that may have been prescribed years and years ago that's just sitting there in the medicine cabinet, either lock it up or take advantage of the upcoming drug take-back day.
Right, because the main strategy that we're trying to get out there is to reduce the supply that can be illegally used. And you've pointed out that having them sitting around in medicine cabinets is probably a really bad. So the good news here in Connecticut is we have at least 60 communities that are participating, probably more by the time the drug back day comes on April 30th. A lot of times it's a police station, and you can go right into the lobby of the police department and take your medications that you no longer want and put them right into this lockbox. No questions asked. You don't even have to announce yourself. You go right in and dispose of them. And that's helping a lot of people. It's helping anybody that might take them from your house, and it's helping people in your family by getting rid of them.
Yeah, and I guess that also speaks to drugs that may be found by parents or loved ones or a sibling that they know are being kept by someone else in the household for recreational purposes. They don't need to be afraid to go into these police stations and suddenly be surrounded by officers and be in possession of a controlled drug. You literally just walk into these collection points like dropping a letter in a random mailbox. You're not being scrutinized. You're not being questioned. So, you know, even if someone wants to take proactive measures to try to separate the drugs out of the households that they may find, they will not be putting themselves at any kind of risk.
And I can speak firsthand to that because I did go into my local police department, and that just how you described it is exactly what happens. The police are on board with this. We're getting great support. They don't want to see young people die. They don't want to pick the pieces up anymore. So they really are on board with reducing the supply.
Great. Well, we are with Jill Spinetti from the Governor's Prevention Partnership. We're talking about a couple of campaigns that the organization is doing to not only try to raise awareness and stem the opioid epidemic that is gripping Connecticut and the nation, but is also initiating awareness campaign about marijuana, which is one of the gateway drugs that often leads to the consumption of more powerful drugs, including opioids. We're going to come back and talk with Jill Spinetti from the Governor's Prevention Partnership about that initiative and some assistance that they are getting in their efforts from another good friend of the award-winning For the People, Lieutenant Governor Nancy Wyman. And we'll be back to talk about that in just a few minutes. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Come on out for a walk on Sunday, May 1st for the 10th annual ARI Walk for Independence at Cove Island Park in Stamford. This event raises funds and awareness for programs at ARI in support of more than 150 people with developmental disabilities. This fun-filled day will include music and entertainment along with food and a three-mile walk. There's no registration fee. However, all attendees are being asked to raise at least $50. And if you do, you'll receive a T-shirt to commemorate your efforts. If you'd like more information or to register, just go to ARICT.org. Well, thanks for hanging around. Apparently, the issue is as important to you as it is to us here at the award-winning For the People. We're pleased to be with Jill Spinetti from the Governor's Prevention Partnership. She's been a friend of our program and a resource to all of our For the People listeners now. For her 18 years on the Governor's Prevention Partnership, we have been featuring that organization on our program since its inception in 1989. And today, more than ever, they're doing important work. Jill, I see that one of the other folks lending their resources and energy to this effort is another close friend of ours, a mutual friend, Lieutenant Governor Nancy Wyman. What's going on with Lieutenant Governor Wyman?
Well, Lieutenant Governor Wyman has taken a strong stand on this issue of disposing of meds, and she actually did a taping for a public service announcement that we're getting around. And anybody that would like to look at it can go right to drugfreect.org. And it's right at the top of that web page. She did a great job of really reminding people to dispose of their meds. And this is an issue that both the governor and lieutenant governor care deeply about. They want to keep people alive, and they want to make sure our young people grow up drug-free. So it's great when they take a leadership role like this.
And I guess there's also, you know, for people who think that it can't happen to them, they can meet the Montez family.
Yes, it's a typical family. You might recognize them as being the neighbors next door. Their son was taking the prescription drugs out of the medicine cabinet, as we just discussed, and the parents knew nothing about it. They didn't know about addiction. They didn't know that their son could become fully addicted and then move on to heroin. And the young person himself just describes the torture that he went through. So what we're trying to do is have other families avoid the same situation by being very knowledgeable about the issue.
So when it comes to the opioid epidemic, which is really escalating here in Connecticut, I mean, this program is broadcasting here in late April, but literally on the day of our broadcast recording, I opened up one of the papers and saw several deaths in the Groton, New London area from opioid overdoses, logged young people in the prime of their lives, you know, cut down by this drug. Of course, they made a choice to take it, but perhaps there just was some other factor to contributing to their untimely passing. But we're losing about two people a day now in Connecticut.
Right. Yes, that's right. And you're right that they're in the prime of life. And, you know, the young people that we talk to have started usually with other drugs, and you reference marijuana, that's something they use, and also alcohol. And young children are starting as early as 11 and 12 years old. And sometimes it's just to experiment, and sometimes they feel depressed or they don't feel good about school. It could be a variety of reasons why they start. When they get to full-blown addiction due to opioids or something like that, they describe it as they're a different person. They can't stop. And so you say choosing to use heroin, they're in such a state that they don't even have their right mind. They're just trying to get through the day.
Sure.
We're trying to keep people alive by use of Narcan. That's it's a drug that brings them back from an overdose. And then hopefully we're getting more and more people into treatment so that they can reclaim their lives.
Mm. Well, I wasn't meaning to say frivolously that folks were taking these. Certainly, when they're begun to be used for recreational or experimental reasons at the early stages of use, this is certainly the most dangerous time, and why we just want to cut the supply and boost the prevention initiative to the point where these kids aren't even experimenting, even for the first time. And that goes as much for opioids as it does for marijuana. So in the last few minutes that we have, we really should divert our attention to this component issue, which is #StopPotCT. Tell me about how that all came about.
Well, marijuana is addictive in and of itself. The THC content in the marijuana that's around these days is very, very strong. We have thousands and thousands of young people that are going into treatment just for marijuana. So we're very concerned about their use, and the rates are going up because the young people aren't getting the message that they think it's harmful, that it's harmful to their health. So we started this campaign because there's legislation afoot and some legislators in Hartford that want to see marijuana legalized in the state of Connecticut, as it has been in several other states, including Colorado and Washington State. So we're starting this opposition to legalization as a voice for people that care and are taking the opposite view. We have a lot of prevention folks, community coalitions, law enforcement. We even have some business and industry associations who are joining the coalition.
So I see that there is something called a marijuana policy boot camp coming up in May.
Yes, and registration's open on our website. It's for people to come and hear about the issues. We have a national expert coming in. We're going to have local experts and people working on the issue of marijuana in the state. And it's a way to get organized. And, the whole purpose is not just to fight legislation. It's really to give a voice to parents and grandparents who want to have a say in our future. Mm-hmm. And it's also to dialogue as a society about the future health of our kids, if their health and their well-being. So I hope anybody listening would consider attending.
All they need to do to get information, access to resources, as well as registration information for this marijuana policy boot camp, is to go to preventionworksct.org.
That's right, or they can call me directly, but going through the website is a great way to get signed up and learn all about the issues.
Great. Jill Spinetti with the Governor's Prevention Partnership. She has been a longtime friend and advocate, as well as a resource to all our listeners here on the award-winning For the People. And we appreciate her joining us now to lend her and the partnership's voice to the prevention component that is contributing to the opioid epidemic, as well as a anti-marijuana campaign. And Jill, you'll probably be thrilled to know I had Governor Daniel Malloy on the show just last Sunday, and I asked him point blank about the possibility of having to legalize recreational use of marijuana as an offset for this massive budgetary revenue shortfall, and he said for now, absolutely not. He is firmly against it. So I'm not sure how much sway that will hold when the red ink begins to really pile on. But for now, at least, the governor himself is standing against the recreational use of marijuana. So hopefully that bodes well for the way and the direction that the state's going to go in the future. But for now, we'll bid you farewell. And thank you so much for all your time and resource and the great work of the Governor's Prevention Partnership. It has been too long since we welcomed back some folks representing Connecticut District Exchange Clubs, and we're pleased to start the program off today with a new friend. Bill Solder is the president of the Connecticut District Exchange Clubs. We'll talk to him for a few minutes before we're joined by Donna Miller. You remember her, perhaps, if you're a regular listener. She was a guest on the program, I'm told, about a year ago. So we'll be talking to her about some of the specific work that she's doing down in southwestern Connecticut. But in the meantime, let's catch up with Bill Solder. Bill, thanks for joining us on the program. Connecticut Exchange Clubs are far and wide across the state, 35 different clubs with almost 1,100 members here in Connecticut. Those are contributing to the great work that exchange clubs are doing across the U.S. and Puerto Rico, who are claiming about 20,000 members, strong membership. So let's talk a little bit about Connecticut and your role. Have you been an exchange club participant for quite a long time?
I have been, and thank you for having me. It's a great privilege to talk about the exchange club. It's something that I'm very passionate about. I'm actually the third generation in my family that have been exchange club members. And my nephews are also exchange clubs. So we have four generations of exchangeites in my family.
Okay. So one of the things that is spectacular about the exchange clubs is that folks who participate on a local basis aren't feeding some sort of machine where they don't see all of the return in their own communities or in their own initiatives. And that's sort of what makes exchange clubs unique, is what you put in locally, you bear the fruits of locally, right?
Yes. Every community has a different need. A community like New Canaan would have a different need than a community of, let's say, Norwalk or Madison or Northeast Connecticut, which is more rural and farmland up there. The members identify the needs in their community, and they meet the needs whatever way they can, either raising money or volunteering or a combination of the two.
Okay. But there are, that being said, some sort of overarching initiatives that you support. Of course, we're going to be talking with our other guest a little bit more because it's Child Abuse Prevention Month. So obviously that speaks to the exchange club's attention to youth programming.
The National Exchange Club is a little over 100 years old, about 105 years. The first program of service they identified was the promotion of commercial aviation. Hmm. If you could imagine 100 years ago, an airplane was a unusual and unique thing, and mm-hmm. the Exchange Club identified that as a possibility of a great asset to the United States. So they actually went and painted red arrows on the roofs of barns, and the red arrows pointed toward the airports. And over time, exchange has changed. The nation has changed. World War II, they sold war bonds. They were instrumental in getting One Nation Under God put into the Pledge of Allegiance, which goes toward our initiative that that we feel that God is important in the lives of the citizens. Very non-denominational. You know, we're not pressing a particular religion, but we just acknowledge the fact that God should be important for a strong community. We do Americanism. We honor people that fly the American flag properly. We honor our veterans. We have an initiative of housing homeless veterans with Veterans Matters. We're partnered up with the Red Cross for community readiness in case of disasters. The one thing that all exchange clubs do is the prevention of child abuse. Every community throughout the country, child abuse is a problem, so we have identified that, and that is our national goal, to prevent child abuse.
Well, that being said, Bill, can you talk to any of the regional or kind of the diversity of the needs in the clubs that you're overseeing here in Connecticut? Are there specific concerns tied to the prevention of child abuse, say in the quiet corner, that are quite different than the needs that may be occurring in New Haven or Bridgeport or Norwalk or Stamford?
You'd be surprised. In every community, there's reports of child abuse, be it Wilton or New Canaan, these beautiful bedroom communities where you think everything is so happy and nice. Mm. DCF gets involved in families, and they forward the information on to Donna Miller or one of the other centers for intervention in these families. A lot of times, it's just ignorance on the fact, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but people just don't know any better. Every year you hear these terrible, tragic stories about, you know, the new parent doesn't know any better, the child's crying, they get upset, and then they shake the baby, and the baby dies. Mm-hmm. And they go, I don't know why the baby died. You know, it's just ignorance that you should never, ever shake a child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may know that, and I may know that, but these, you know, these young mothers or people that just haven't had an opportunity to learn from their parents because maybe they come from a broken home or some kind of tragic situation in their lives. You know, we meet the needs of families wherever they come from, be it an affluent community or somebody in poverty in the inner city.
Excellent. So one of your responsibilities as district president is to build new exchange clubs while supporting existing exchange clubs. Now that you have a voice through a statewide network, as we're partnering with you on this morning, what are a few of the things you'd like to say to communities that do not have exchange clubs where you might like to build new initiatives? Are there particular communities where you found that exchange clubs could play a really important role where they have not yet been established here in Connecticut?
You know, exchange starts with people. And if you are the kind of person that would stop and pick up a piece of litter on the street because you know that that's going to take away from your community if you see a piece of litter on the street, then you would be a perfect person to be in the exchange club. If you are the kind of person that would hold the door for an old lady that's coming out of the grocery store with a bag of groceries, you'd be a perfect exchangeite because you're giving of yourself. Now, there's selfish reasons for being in the exchange club. I own my own construction company. And because of the people I meet every day at these meetings and I see in my capacity as an exchange club member, it's just a natural occurrence that I generate business. They see me, they know me, they trust me, and I get business out of it. So there's a business networking aspect of it. Exchange was started 100 years ago in Detroit, and it was a jeweler and the guy that owned the haberdashery and a doctor and a lawyer, and they all got together and they talked about business and how to grow their business. That's what it was started as, a community outreach, but also as a business networking. So on a selfish level, anybody that wants to grow their business and network their business and meet other like-minded people, the Exchange Club is for you. And as far as communities go, the Connecticut District Exchange Club, which is all the exchange clubs in Connecticut, we raise $1 million a year. And that $1 million turns right around and goes into our community. The Norwalk Club buys all the T-shirts for the D.A.R.E. program that the police do with the middle schools.
Sure.
Every single T-shirt is paid for by the Exchange Club. If the Exchange Club wasn't in Norwalk, who would pay for those T-shirts? Who would support the Boy Scouts? Who would support the Senior Center, buy the pool table for the Senior Center, or buy a park bench, or do these things? The Exchange Club in the community, whatever community it is, identifying the need and meeting those needs.
Excellent. Well, we're going to ratchet the focus in right now with our next guest, Donna Miller, and the Exchange Club Parenting Center in Fairfield County. But in the meantime, we appreciate your taking some time to give our listeners and me some orientation on exactly what exchange clubs are and the great work that they're doing, both reinforcing the national American spirit as well as doing something as simple as picking up a piece of litter holding a door for someone and evidencing and modeling the kind of behavior that we would hope and like to see in everyone here in Connecticut and anywhere. Bill Solder is president of the Connecticut District Exchange Clubs. Bill, before we say goodbye, let folks know how they can get in touch if they're interested in becoming a member or perhaps chartering an exchange club in their community.
www.exchangeclub.com. It's as simple as that. The national website is nationalexchangeclub.org. Please reach out to us, and we will be more than happy to meet you where you are and start a club, have you join the club if you have one near you. We're all about membership. We're all about helping our communities, and we're all about the prevention of child abuse. Thank you very much.
So we're glad to have Donna back on the program. Donna Miller is the director of the Exchange Club Parenting Center down in Fairfield County. We've got a couple of events coming up to benefit Exchange Clubs, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a couple minutes. But Donna, thanks for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here with you.
So we came to you, as we had in the past, to sort of present some real immediate hands-on evidence of the benefits that the exchange clubs bring to young people. We're here in a child abuse awareness mode. Certainly, you and your organization has affected historic improvements and protections and opportunities for children in crisis. Tell us a little bit about the Exchange Club Parenting Center that you run, which is one of three, I believe, in Connecticut.
That's right. Well, the one we run is located in Stamford, Connecticut, but it serves Fairfield County. And our programs are all structured to make an impact in breaking the cycle of child abuse and to prevent basically the destruction of a child's self-worth. You know, in life, we either feel secure because we're able to experience being with our family members, or insecure because of the specific ways that doesn't exactly show up correctly for us. And it's important for kids to feel safe with their caretakers. So we work very closely on attachment and the relationship between children and their caregivers, their families, their parents. We look at coherence, making sense of their values, their behaviors, and then their understanding of how to pass that down to their children without anger and violence and unrealistic expectations. So we teach safe parenting based on ages and stages of development. And, you know, the closer the connection between the parent and the child and the relationship, the less likely it is to get out of hand.
So what do you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, no.
I was going to say, since we last visited, tell me a little bit about the outcomes of this model. Are you enjoying a great range of success as a result of the exchange clubs and your agency's involvement?
Yes. Well, you know, the exchange club, the national organization, it has a scientifically based, research-based evidence model that we use. And you have to go through some certification and training in order to get fully accredited in it. So our staff are all professional social workers. They speak Spanish, Creole, you know, English, so we can really work with the populations that we find residing here in Fairfield County. And some of the most important, I think, outcomes are, of course, that children are feeling loved and protected and safe in their homes. That's number one. But we reduce out-of-home placements and foster care and things like that. We reduce isolation due to culture and language barriers. Again, we foster those closer relationships between children and parents. The community as a whole, we connect families to healthcare partners, schools, housing. So the quality of life is greatly improved in the small 4 to 6 month understand that we work with the children and the families.
That's great news. Well, in the last minute or two that we have with you, we want to let folks know how they can support the great work that you're doing at the Parenting Center and with the through the exchange clubs. And that brings us to an invitation to come down to the Stamford Palace Theater on May 1st. What's that event?
Yes, on May 1st at the Palace Theater, we have a wonderful event called Live, Laugh, Love. And we'll have Frank Mastrone, a Broadway actor and performer, singing the Clark Eno Orchestra and comedy by Kit Demko. It should be a really fun event. Starts at 6 p.m. Come on down. Bring your family. That's going to be great fun.
And,
also on June 2nd, if I could mention, we have a golf tournament at Sterling Farms all day and a beautiful dinner to wrap it up. And, you know, if you want anyone wants any further information, they can call the center at 203-327-9419 or visit our website at www.exchangeclubparentingskillscenter.com.
Can they also link to that through the Connecticut District Exchange Club website?
I don't know if they have that up yet, but I do believe they will have that up in the next week or two. Yes.
Okay, so hit us one more time with your website.
www.exchangeclubparentingskillscenter.com.
Excellent.
Donna, and if anyone lives in the Hartford area, KidSafe is doing, our sister organization is doing a bowl-a-thon April 23rd. It's a Saturday from 12:30 to 3:30 at Fair Time Bowling Alleys.
Fantastic.
In Vernon, Connecticut.
So from Fairfield County to the capital city and the capital region, great events, great way to get to know exchange clubs in your region. Perhaps you'd like to start one or be a member of one, as we heard from our first guest, the organization president, Bill Solder. You can go to the statewide website, ctdistrictexchange.com. And we'd like to thank our guest, just wrapping up with us this morning, Donna Miller. She is with the Exchange Club Parenting Center down in Fairfield County. Donna, thanks for your great work and your great spokesing for exchange clubs. And good luck with your events.
Thank you. Thank you, and I hope everybody joins us in helping kids hope, educate, love, and protect them.
Great. May 1st, Live, Laugh, Love at the Stamford Palace Theater, and June 2nd, get your golf clubs out for their benefit golf tournament and support exchange clubs. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and don't necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.vocat, V as in Victor, O-K-E-T, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People, or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab on our station's website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.